in the very early days.
I'm gonna test
log
that.
Log cabins, the town was made up of all log cabins and all that kind of things, you know,
yeah.
And so on and so forth. Right? From the time that I came to Alaska here, the year and what how it was and so forth, and what caused us to come here, and I'll just carry right on and tell you the things that happened here and there and so forth. But whether you use my name into it or not, or this is my life or anything, and I really haven't done anything, you know.
Well, I don't know, Stan. I think you really have, you've led an interesting life from what little I've talked to you.
Yeah, I've been interesting. You better have. It's your life. I've enjoyed every bit of it. I wish I could stay here another 50 years.
Here. I'm just checking my machine here on the dials and stuff. But that's a beautiful thing. Is that Mount Sanford?
No, that's Mount Hayes in the Panama River.
Oh, I see, of course.
I've been working on that. I don't know. I just started it for a long time and I picked it up from about a quarter mile. I said, yeah, I don't know. They make anything out of it or not. This is clean, you know. Nobody will have any feeling they don't think to it.
Oh, Stan, I think that has a lot of feeling to it. It's the fireweed and the river, the composition is very nice. You've got a beautiful sweep to the river there. You have a beautiful sweep to the river. The curve of the river is nice.
Well, you can see that when you go up here on the Chena Ridge up and around in there. I happen to look out across there and so forth. And then down here at the bluff in there, you see that sweeping in the mountains. And that's just about where I was, you know, that time.
Down towards Salter River?
Yeah, down here where the big bluff is, about, what is this here, 20? Beyond North Pole down there is the bluff.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Cash Creek Bluff.
Yes.
Right in there.
Climb up and look out over the valley.
Somewhere in there, yeah. It was some time ago because I just started that. I had worked on it for a year, I guess.
Is that so?
Well, you tell me when you're ready, and I'll start right here.
Well, I'm just waiting for that cup of coffee.
Okay, that's what I'm doing. Have you been doing anything, getting out or anything?
Well, we went camping a couple of weeks ago. Huh? Bob had a week off, and we went down to Chitna.
Oh, you did?
And I guess you could start talking if you wanted to start telling me. First of all, today is what, the 25th of June?
This is the 25th of June.
Yeah.
Just the day of Tuesday, the 25th of June, yeah.
And you're Stan Young and I'm Neville Jacobs, and this really isn't a formal interview. You know, this is done on a request for the Historical Society and the Pioneers to put together a series of conversations. Like as if you were just listening into a conversation. All right, I've been doing these as interviews partly, you know. But,
well,
you might start in by telling me where you came from originally.
Yes, I'll start right from the beginning of how I got here and everything. Things were pretty tough in the States. If you want to get your machine to go in, why I'll...
Well, it's going. It's going.
Okay, it was very tough in the States at this time. It was 1924, and it was a hard time. People couldn't get jobs. People were being laid off. Oh, there was better thousands and thousands. And I was a young fellow, and just got out of school. I graduated from high school, and of course I was out to make my fortune, you know, as everybody else. And I couldn't get a job. Couldn't get a job here, and I couldn't get a job there. And it was just really, really, really hard. I even had to bum my feet and bob a dime here and there to get a cup of coffee and a donut and so on and so forth in Seattle and such. And the uncle that I graduated from school with was with me at the time. It was getting too tough for him, and he couldn't drive day, so he said he was going to go home back over in the Yakima Valley. That's where I was raised, early days there. And so he went home for a while, and I stayed. I couldn't go home because, well, they need everything at home. There was other children there at home, and my father had died when I was around 12 years old. I was the oldest boy at home, and it seemed like that I was supposed to take care of him, you know, and do the best I could, and I was just ashamed to go home because I hadn't made anything better and so forth. But anyway, he came back to Seattle, and when he'd gotten enough money from his parents to pay our fare to Ketchikan. Well, the reason we wanted to come to Alaska was we were around there at the employment offices, and at the employment offices there was always these big signs up there: miners and muckers wanted for Kennicott, Alaska. Miners and muckers for Kennicott, Alaska. Well, they would never send us up there because we had no experience, you know, young fellows, and we couldn't get a job through them. And so if we figured that we could make our way up, we could get a job there. So when he came back, he had enough money to pay our steerage to Ketchikan. That was $17.50 each on the steerage. Well, we got on the boat and we went in and got to Ketchikan. Well, in them early days, it was hard to get men to work in Alaska and stay in Alaska to work. And you could longshore from the boat to the windcomb, or you could longshore on the windcomb. They were glad to have you. So, we got to Ketchikan. Why, that was as far as we could go, you see, because we didn't take it. We had to stow away from there on. We'd be thrown away from there. But anyway, we longshored. But we didn't go off the boat because we were afraid we'd never get back on again, you know. But we longshored, and they took our time and gave it to the purser. Well, when the boat took off, why, we stayed on the boat, stowed away, and kept quiet, and so on and so forth. They didn't know we were there. And every time we come to one of these little places, why, we would longshore, but we'd longshore on the boat. We'd sit and wrangle and all in little places. They were just little hamlets, all they were, you know. And you could always count the population right there on the dock when the boat came in. The boat would whistle and everybody had come from the town down on the dock. And you could count the whole town. They'd be all there, anxious, you know, to see new people or new faces and so on and so forth. And anyway, we longshored at every one of these places, all along the way. Yakutat, Skagway, and all that. The boat stopped at every little place, you know, it seems like. And when we got into Cordova, why, that was where we wanted to go to Cordova to get to go up to the Kennicott Copper. The Kennicott Copper Mine was about 200 miles interior over the Copper River Railroad at that time. We got to Cordova by, we were mum broke, you know, and we were afraid to go and ask for our money from the purser because they would take us back to Seattle. That was the law at that time, and so they took us back, you know. So we couldn't ask for our money at all. Then we got off the boat, we were absolutely broke, and it was late in the evening and everything like that there, and we went up to the town in Cordova. You had to go up from the dock to the town. And we got up to the town, we went into a club there. It was kind of a pool room, you know, and everything. It was low ceiling and all dark in there. You could hardly see just a little light over a pool table here and there. And people were playing cards, gambling wide open in them days and so forth. But there was a big long hall building, like, you know. Sold cigarettes and cigars and tobacco and everything in the front, and then the card room, the pool table. And then way in the back was a restaurant, like kind of a counter for, just a counter there. And along the sides there was homemade benches. There's homemade benches there and there on the sides. It was kind of dark in there. And me and my friend or partner, we came in there and we sat down on one of these benches along the wall there, you know. And I guess we must have looked pretty well down the harbor and so forth. Probably showed pretty well. And some old geezer, old fellow, comes over to us and says, "Well, boys, it can't be that tough, can it?" Well, he said, "I didn't know. It was pretty tough. We were in a strange place and broke and don't know what to do." And, "Oh, heck," he said, "we're all broke up here. That's not, nobody here got any money. You come on with me, I'll take you over to my boarding house." Said, "Well, we can't go to your boarding house here if you have any money." "That's all right," he says, "come on." He went over, took her across the street and into a boarding house. There was a great big Norwegian lady had this place. She was just as rough and rugged as they make them. Her heart was just as big as she was. And he said, "I brought you in some new boarders." I told him, he said, we can't stay here. We haven't got any money." He said, "Turn the book around, put your name down there. I'll show you where to stay and sleep." They never think anything like that in the States, you know. They'd throw you out in the streets and so forth. And anyway, we signed our name, and she took us back in the back there and then signed us a bunk to where the one and everything. And we stayed there for about a week. And we were rustling a job, trying to get a job, and couldn't get a job. And we were getting in debt more and more. And we didn't know when she'd be throwing us out, you know. But anyway, we went up to her and we told her, we says, "We've got to leave here. We can't stay here anymore." I says, we haven't got any money to pay you for it." "You kids just been bothering me all the time you've been here. Get back here and hate yourself." So, there's another week. I guess we got a job then. We did rustle a job to go to Kennecott. That's about 200 miles up in the interior, the copper mine country. So we came in and we told her, we says, "We got a job and we have our tickets here, and just as soon as we go to work, well, we'll send the money back down to you to pay for our lunch home." "That's all right, that's what everybody does around here." "He says, now get your stuff and get out of here." Well, that's the way it was, you see. The fishermen out of Cordova there, they make their big money, you know, and so on and so forth. They come in there.
Hey, Stan, you're going to break the mic.
What?
You're going to break the mic.
They come in there, you know, I'm hard hearing, you know, I get to talking pretty loud. Anyway, they fish, you know, and they make their big money, and they come in there in the fall, and they spend every dime of it. The town lives on that, you see. They spend every dime, and then they live on credit for the rest of the winter. They're taking care of them. Then in the spring they go out and make them come in and pay their debts and live over there like that. Then that's the way it was all over Alaska. It was the same way. That's the way they did. The miners done the same. Come to town, they'd blow their money just like that, you know, and so forth. But anyway, we went on up to Kennecott. This was in March, 1924, and early in March. Lots of snow on the ground yet. And as the train pulled out of there, they had to have a double header, two engines on the. It was made up of some freight cars and one passenger car on the back. And we went through places there, Chittenden and all those going into there, and places all along the way where you couldn't see out the window, you just see snow. It was up as high as the car, the cuts were. And it's a heavy snow belt in that part of the country, out of Cordova and up in that part of the area. And we got into Kennecott and they worked there. I worked there in Kennecott for a couple of years, and I got acquainted with a young fellow there that his dad had staked a lot of ground over in the Shoshana country. That's way back in there, at the very headwaters of the Tanana River. And what they called the Shoshana Stampede, or Shoshana is what you call them. Anyway, his father...
Now that's spelled, what, C-H-I something? It doesn't look like it's pronounced.
You can't, I don't think you'll ever
Chisana
find
it.
Chisana
is the way it's spelled.
Shoshana is the way the Indians say it.
Yes.
They changed it to Shoshana, but Chisana is a lot that are known as by, but Shoshana is really the name.
That's what I heard it called, Shoshana, when I first came up to this country. And that's,
anyway, this is very early days, and I got acquainted with him, and we planned that we would make enough money to go back in there and mine. But of course, the Kennecott itself is interesting too. The
Kennecott Copper Corporation that run about 40% underhanded at all times. They couldn't get men to come up there and go to work. It was quite isolated, you know, very isolated. And it wasn't like it is today. These people out here on the pipeline, they don't know what isolation is. In them days, we didn't have the airplane. We didn't have the radios either, you know, or the TVs or anything of the kind, you know. It was up there. It was stuck there. And, of course, they average up there a crazy man and a suicide a month, once a month. In them days, they just couldn't take it. Different ones couldn't take it. There was a lot of gambling going on. There was lots of fellows there that would get their pay and they would gamble it off. In a few days, two or three days after payday, they were broke, and they stayed there 2 and 3 years at a time and so forth. And they wouldn't have a dime. Every payday, they'd do the same thing. You know, the company used to hire these Greeks from Seattle, especially. And have them come up there to gamble, special gamblers, you know, real gamblers, you know, to come up there just to keep these people broke, keep these fellows broke, so they keep them on the job. Well, after payday, why, this game, big games would go on, you know, and the different ones would be dropping out. They'd lost their money, and you'd get down to where there's four or five of these Greeks playing the real gamblers, you know, with each other. Pretty soon, one of them makes it all and takes off. He's gone. He made his stake, you see. And that's the way it was, just month after month for a lot of them. Well, I didn't do that. I never gambled a young fellow. I had to send quite a little bit of my money home to my mother and then the rest of the children and so on and so forth. And that's the way I never got into any of those kind of things and such. I never have, as far as that goes. I don't think much of that gambling business, or gambling business or something like that there. But anyway, that was the experiences at the Kennecott mine and the mill work and so forth in that day, early days. And then...
About how many people were there at Kennecott?
Well, now, I imagine that they hired somewhere around 400 or 500 men, probably. The mill was down by the railroad, and then that's the copper mill. And the mines were way back in the mountains. They had to go across the big canyon there with they had a regular aerial tramway, a 4-mile tramway. They went across a great big deep canyon, 400 feet down from the wind column there. And that's the only way they had to go in there to go to that mine, and that's the way the copper came out. It was on the traveling, endless cable. And these buckets just coming in and around and in and around and in and around and then being dumped. They got up at the tipple, why at the very top, why the young fellows were the bucket chasers. A couple of them there, and they'd grab a bucket, you know, and uncouple it from the traction cable and dump it, hook it back on the traction cable and grab another, and each one of them, you know, and get all day long, they're dumping these buckets of wind gold. A bucket would hold about a yard of muck or mineral mine and stuff, and rock. And that would be going on, and that's the only way they had to going up to that mine would be over that tramway. It would be quite scary, you know, and so forth, everything. But anyway, my friend and I, we got enough money to get ourselves an outfit together to go back in the Shoshana country to mine. And we had to go in. We went in over the headwaters.
Now, who was your friend?
Barney McKinney. He's dead now. He was about my age at the time, but he's gone. He went quite early, quite a few years back that Barney died. He was quite a boy. Barney was a foster son of Doug McKinney. Doug McKinney is gone too, you know. He was one of the real early timers, Doug McKinney. And at this time he was living in McCarthy, about 4 miles from the Kennecott mine and mill part that McCarthy is. It was just a little bit of a town McCarthy was, made up of gamblers and bootleggers and sports and so forth and such. And anyway, Dud McKinney was quite a gambler. And anyway, Dud McKinney, early days, had a big roadhouse of some kind or another over on the 40 mile, at the mouth of the 40 mile run into the Yukon. And he run that there, and this place got on fire. And I think it was that somehow or another the father of this child got burned up in this place, and Dud McKinney took the boy to raise. And Barney was quite a boy. Barney had never had any education amount to anything in school and so forth, but he had educated himself. And if you wanted to know anything, all you had to do from all over the camp would go to Barney and ask him about this and about that there. He certainly was a studious sort of a fellow. He was just up on everything, and he taught himself in every way, law and everything, in every way. And he was sure a sharp fellow, Barney was. Barney was about a quarter Indian. Anyway, and a good worker, a hard worker, and he'd been working there at the Kennicott's quite a while before I came there, and I worked 2 years after I was that in.
What happened to your partner that came up with you
on
the boat?
He went on up into the mine to work across the tramway. That would be about 4 miles across, 4 or 5 miles across this canyon, you know, to work at the mine. And I think he had something to do with the loading of the tramway, loading of these buckets over on that end. And I went to work at the mill on this side about 4 or 5 miles. I didn't get to see him again for very often, just once in a great while because he was up there and everything. But he stayed about 18 months and went and left and went back home again. Now, I never heard from him again, never heard from these folks or anything else. I don't know whatever become of this young fellow. Joe Morgan. I don't know what ever become of him. Anyway, when we got our outfit made, so we could go back into the Shoshana country and mine, we went over the White River Glacier. Yeah, that's the Russell Glacier. That's the headwaters of the White River. And across the Solo Pass and so on and so forth. Well, anyway, we had our outfit packed in there by pack horses at them days. And a fellow by the name of Joe Molloy. I just read not long ago where Joe Molloy is in the Alaska Sportsman. Joe Molloy and his wife were the old timers, they had the queen and the king and so forth.
Regents.
And they were playing the regents at White Horse or something like this, not very long ago. Joe Molloy was a packer and a headhunter and so forth. And he took our outfit. And I don't know now, that's been a year or two ago that I seen that in Alaska Sportsman. And I don't know whether he's still alive or not, but an awful lot of those old timers and so forth are gone, you know, that I'm talking a lot about. Like Doug McKinney's gone, Barney McKinney's gone, and so forth. But anyway, he went on in ahead of us with our outfit on the pack horses and so forth. And we followed behind with a big pack on our back, you know. Well, we were days way, way behind him because he just kept right on and going. He left us when he must have left us on the glacier. I may have a picture of us on the glacier at the last. I don't know if I could find it or not. But anyway, when you go across the White River, then you go over what they call the Solo Pass. That's a long, low pass, and the mountains are a long ways apart and everything. And this was late in the fall, way late in the fall. They were going to get in there before the snow. So we didn't take any snowshoes with us or anything. And we got to the what they call the relief cabin and on the Solo, this is a Solo Pass. The government relief cabin was built there, a log cabin. And we stayed there overnight, late in the fall, and when we got up in the morning, it was snowing and misting, and it was, you could hardly see the mountains any place, you know, anywhere. It was very early in the morning, somewhere around 5 o'clock in the morning, we got ready to go get on the trail. We wanted to get there, and it was snowing, and it must have been about 2 or 3 inches of snow on the ground in the morning. And we figured it was early, you know, that it would clear up, and we'd be able to see the mountains and so forth. And not having any snowshoes or anything else with us. Well, we took off anyway, and we had to go about 20-some miles to our next cabin. We would have 20, 25 miles to the next cabin where we'd just stay overnight. But anyway, we started out of there at 5 o'clock in the morning, and we traveled.
And it kept snowing. snowing and snowing and snowing, and we were walking in snow up to our knees. We were finally walking into it to the knees, and we've been going and going and going, and never come to this cabin. Nope, no time at all.
Well, thanks, Sam.
And believe me, we were getting pretty doggone tired, you know, and it was getting dark. We never did get to see the mountains and tell where we were going or anything of kind. We finally came right back to the cabin that we had left at 5 o'clock in the morning at 9 o'clock at night that night. We had been traveling in circles. All we had been doing traveling in circles, and we were mighty lucky that we got back to that cabin, believe me. And that cabin looked awful good to us, I tell you. Well, the next morning, why, we had to break trail then to make it yet. Do you use cream, too?
No, thank you.
And I do.
Go ahead.
Well, yes, that coffee is still hot, isn't it?
Oh, sure. Steaming
coffee,
away here.
You know, and forget all about it. Coffee thing is here.
Boy, that's a beautiful country, too. Bob and I were just down there at Chittenah 2 weeks ago. I was painting Mount Wrangell down there. Mm-hmm. And I was looking at the map. I had a topographic map, and I was looking at that country thinking I'd like to fly over it or see it, you know?
Oh, that is. That's a wonderful country back in there. Believe me.
I'll bet there was a lot of game there.
Well, I'll tell you about that, too.
Okay.
I bet there was.
Well, you got into the cabin that night.
Well, next morning we had to take off there, and we break trail while first one of us would be in front of the other. No snowshoes. We had to travel through all the snow and everything. But we did make our 20 miles to the next cabin, all right, and we got into the Shoshana in good shape, so forth. And we're mining in there. I could tell you about the mining and so forth in there at that time. There wasn't very many people in there at that time. It was one of the biggest log cabin cities in the early days. It was, I guess, a claim. There's a lot of empty log cabins in there. There's lots of them. There was about four or five different people in there at the time. It was Billy James. He was the original staker in there. He found the gold in there. He was the original discoverer. Billy James, big fellow, and his wife, and they would generally go out in the fall and come back in the winter, but some years they'd stay in there too, as far as that goes. And then there was the storekeeper, Simons, and then there was a commissioner in there, Foghorn Nelson, and all of those ones. And I'll tell you about these fellows and how they got their name and everything. And so forth. In any place you went, why, most always it was, they hang a nickname onto somebody. I don't know what they ever called me. Probably Shorty, most of the time. Anyway, there were just a few of them in there. And Billy James was the one that found the gold in there, and they were only a few of them left in there that was working this land and so forth, working the ground here and there. And he was working on Bonanza Creek, what they call Bonanza Creek. And his partner was Too Much Johnson. Billy James, they always called him Billy, as it wasn't called. And Too Much Johnson, and he was a fellow that he got his name as being Too Much Johnson because he told stories too big. You know, stretched them a little bit, you know, to make them interesting, I guess. And they go, that's the way he got his name. And then there was the storekeeper, Clubfoot Simons. Clubfoot Simons had got me feet froze off a little bit, you know, to make them interesting, I guess. And they go, that's the way he got his name. And then there was the storekeeper, Clubfoot Simons. Clubfoot Simons had got his feet froze off, and they had cut them off right above the right around the instep there, and they called him Clubfoot after that there. But anyway, the way this happened is that they used to have to bring their stuff in there to the store by dog team in the winter time, or by pack horse in the summertime. Most of the time they brought it in the winter time. They'd bring it over the winter trail. And they used to have a dog team bring the Shoshana Glacier itself is about 40 miles across the Shoshana. That's the headwaters of the Tanana. It's about 40 miles across the Shoshana Glacier.
where you go, and you have to camp on the middle of it. Well, the people, the dog teams and so forth would come up on the other side from McCarthy, bringing their, from the railroad, McCarthy, bringing the freight up there. And then the dog teams from this side, from the Shoshana side, would go up there and meet them on the Wethercombe. They'd stay overnight, probably camp right on the glen. You go up on this glacier, you take your wood with you, so that you can have a fire up there and so forth. Well, we were bringing in freight in there for Clubfoot Simons' store. He was Simons at that time. But anyway, this is how he lost his foot and feet. We got into overflow. Now, you want more coffee, you just walk over there and help yourself, understand? And he got into this overflow. There was about three teams, about three dog teams. And we got into this overflow, and he got wet, and all of us got wet, and so on and so forth, and got up on the glacier. This was very, very early in the spring, very, very early in the spring. And when we got to camp up there, made up our fires and everything like that there, we all took our, waiting for the other outfits to come in, you know, to come up and grab the freight and take it on over, you know. And we, all of us changed our stockings and our socks, our wool socks and everything, got them all, you know, off of us and put on dry ones before we went into our sleeping bag. And we told this Simons, it always is this way with the old timers in them days, it was always the ones that got into trouble was the old timers that's been in the country all length of time. They get careless, they get, they know and say they know this and that and so forth. And anyway, we told him he'd better change his socks, get on dry socks and then in his sleeping bag, but now he got into it anyway, just like that there, and he froze his feet. His feet was froze. Well, the teams came up and they hooked all, Tumas Johnson hooked up 21 dogs, put 21 dogs, took teams off of the others and 21 dogs and put them in the sled and took them to McCarthy. And I guess he whipped them dogs all the way in there. He made a record run, 100 and some miles in about 13 hours, something like that there. And it took him into the hospital and they had to cut his feet off. He cut it off right above the wind inset along in there. Well, then he was called Clubfoot Simon from that time on when he came back.
He had half of his feet.
Yes.
And
yes,
he could still walk all right.
Oh, yes, to some extent. He'd get around better than what he tried to anyway, I'll tell you that. Anyway, he was a big fat fellow. Well, that's the way that he got his name. And
well,
he was quite a guy. This store man was quite a guy. He was pretty lazy and everything. He'd gotten that way. And he had a store and he has a one of these barrel stoves, you know, the barrel stove, and it's facing the door of the house. And he was too lazy to get out and get his wood and everything, so we would help him. We'd get the wood in and we'd bring it in to him about 8 foot length, you know. Now he could get out there and saw this wood up if he wanted to. He could stand there and saw just as well as not, and it'd been good for him to do so. But he just gotten fatter and lazier and everything else, you know, and in that way, why back there, well, that's the way he was, that's all. Anyway, in the winter time when we weren't mining or we'd be trapping or something like that, and then we might gather all together in the little town, not the town, just the log cabin, everybody had a log cabin, about five of us there at the time. And we would go down to his place to play poker, you know, we'd play a little penny ante poker, maybe two-bit limits and so on and so forth there. And entertain. But anyway, we would look down to the cabin there, down to the store, and we'd see the door open, you know, we'd see a light. Well, we'd say, Clubfoot Simons put another log on the stove. He was too lazy to cut this logs into stove-foot length, you know. So they were too long to go in the house and to leave the door open, and he put the stove in, and it burned off while he get it in the house. And closed the door. He was quite a guy. He had a round table, and it was right in front of the shelves of the groceries, you know, where the groceries was and everything, and a bench. And he sat there on this bench and at the round table, and he would reach back on the shelf back of him, and he would grab a can, whatever he grabbed, why he'd open up and eat it and throw the can underneath the table. Well, then as we got through eating, why the big heavy set that fellow and everything, he would lean way back in his twin comb and go off to sleep, and his big belly just nice, you know, sloping like that there. So that he had a little bit of a black dog, curly-haired black dog, and he'd crawl up there and lick his face, and that would be the only time that Simon would get his face washed. We would bring in blueberries to him, and you could still see the blueberry stains on his bald head in the springtime. But he was a fine fellow, just the same. Just one of the old-timers, that's all it was. And as I said before, the Too Much Johnson, he got his name because he told too big a story. And there's Foghorn Nelson, he's a commissioner, and he was an old man, 80-some years old. He was a Norwegian, and a husky, raw-boned fellow, you know, and everything. And he talked with a very deep voice, very important man. He was a commissioner. He didn't have nobody to, there was no recording or nothing else going on in there, but he was very important. He was the important man of the town, and he talked with a very deep voice and so forth, as if he was a judge on one of the biggest courts in the world. Quite a character. And this deep voice, why they called him Foghorn Nelson, they called him. Then there was another fellow that stayed there in the camp, stayed there all the time, and he was a mine. He mined down on Gold Run. That's where we mined too, was on Gold Run. And he mined below us. He had ground below us. And he was an Irishman, Irish Jack Carroll. They called him the Irishman. And of course, that's the way he got his name, because he was an Irishman. And that was just about all. Well, there was a fellow by the name of Don Green, and he's a trapper. He didn't do much mining. He'd been in there a long time, and he had to help survey the line between Canada and the United States, and he'd worked on that survey line. And he had stayed in there and trapped. That's probably the only thing that Don ever done was trap in the wintertime and so forth. And he'd show up every now and then and poker games and so forth in the winter. Anyway, the mining back in there was all by hand, all by hand. Everything was by hand. There was no machinery of anything. The gold in Shoshana and all of all the bonanza, the original creek and the Gold Run and all was right in the grass roots, what they call the grass roots. They're shallow, very shallow, one comb. And they would take it and build a hand dam with timber across some of the bigger ones, like Billy James across the Shoshana. There would be a dam put up by timber, and this timber was hauled in there years ago. It was a whipsawed or something or other, I don't know. But anyway, he put this dam in, a dam of water to use for his sluicing and the mining and so on and so forth. And with us, we had to put a dam in. We put in a moss dam. When we got there in the fall, it was still, the snow had went off again, and it was down lower land anyway. And we went up on our claims, and we had to put this dam in the fall because we wanted to get a lake of water in the spring to do our sluicing. And so we had to go up there, and we have to, by hand, you have to cut the moss off of the banks of the creek. And you cut this moss off with a grub hoe or axe or something other in chunks. And you use that, we had to cut it in chunks in order to use it for our dam, this moss. Well, we had dug down to bedrock across the creek. It was just a narrow, very narrow creek. I'd say about, maybe on the top would be about 50 feet across. We had to have a dam about 50 feet long across there. Well, we dug down to bedrock, and then we took and cleared this moss and grass off of the side of the windcomb of our claim, you know, so what we're going to mine the next spring. And we used this moss to build up the dam. And we put a spillway, that's a gate, in the middle of our dam to work automatically, you know. It closes, you know, down when the lake goes down, your gate closes, you see, and the water builds up in your lake. Well, we got this dam in and our sluice boxes all up and everything that we're going to use and the spillway in and so forth. And then we stayed for the winter and we trapped during the winter and so forth. But anyway, we had to go hunting. Everybody had to get the meat, you know, for the winter. And a lot of them were these old fellows that couldn't go out and hunt anymore. And so Barney and I were the youngest ones. And Jack Carroll had the dog team. Nobody else had dogs in there except Jack Carroll, Irish Carroll, Jack. And so Barney and I, we'd go hunting, we'd get the meat for the camp. We'd get meat for Clubfoot Simons and Foghorn Nelson and for Irish Jack and ourselves. Well, we left Shoshana. Now, this is how game was in them days. And game in that part of the country, I imagine, is pretty good yet because there's not nobody back in there or anything. And this is where all the big game guides and so forth, the headhunters, would take their hunters back in there in the early days. And in those days, they used pack horses to take their hunters out. There was Con Miller out of Cordova. He would bring his hunters in. He'd get a couple of hunters a year, about all they would get, about 200, and he'd have them out for 60 days. At this year that I'll tell you about, why, he had two fellows that was in the manufacturing cracker business or something in San Francisco, millionaires, and they had 22 head of horses, Con Miller and them, and they were out for 60 days hunting back in there. And the same way with Harry Boyden. Harry Boyden and Con Miller and them, they're all gone. They're old. They were all guides and everything, and packers and so forth. And Harry Boyden had a big outfit too. And he's taking them back in there in them days, hunters. But anyway, Barney and I went afoot, and we left Shoshana. And we went out, we were gone. We didn't go more than 25 miles, probably. We went over the Beaver Pass and down the Little Beaver. Now you cross the Beaver by the road, but this was up at the headwaters of the Beaver. You cross the Beaver on the highway going to the state.
Go to the next side of the tape.